So this next talk is a personal friend of mine, Paul Vick. He is an architect on the Oslo team, my team. Woo-hoo. He's our token Microsoft speaker so that we can have the rest of the conference on the Microsoft campus. He actually started Microsoft 17 years ago on the Access team. So he's been doing this Microsoft stuff and this data stuff for a long, long time, and this language stuff, because in the middle, between Oslo and Access, he did a little thing called Visual Basic, and he was in charge of their compiler. So he's way into this stuff. Put your hands together for Paul Vick.
Thank you very much. I find it a little intimidating. I didn't think about the fact that I was only Microsoft speaker here. I feel like I'm carrying the weight of the company. So if I suck, I know if I suck, you know, I'm not representative. If I'm great, then I guess I am. all right. So what we're going to talk about, how many people here were here at the Lang.net earlier and saw the M talk we gave this morning? Okay, so we're not actually going to do too much overlap, but we will do a little bit. What I'm going to focus on in this talk is the DSL capabilities of the M modeling language. And we're just going to focus only on language. There's a lot else to the language, the M language, that we're just not going to talk about. So I'm going to just start by giving a very, very quick and brief sort of a locational, positional kind of setup here. So M is a part of Oslo. And Oslo is a general platform for model-driven applications. And there are three pieces to it. There's a repository, a database, Quadrant, which is a visual modeling tool, and M, which is a textual modeling language. So I'm only going to talk about M in this talk. And if you want more information about the other pieces of Oslo, there'll be a website at the end of my talk. You can go and find lots of stuff out about it. And if we look at M, actually, there are four sort of main concepts in M make up the language. There's a language component for defining DSLs. There's a data model. There's a set of capabilities for doing data transformations, querying and projections, and constraints, so specifying schema, doing validation, that sort of thing. We're only going to talk about the language and the data part of M today. In fact, actually, we're really just going to mostly talk about the language. So there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot to M that I'm not going to touch on. So again, at the end of the talk, there'll be some pointers if you want to know more about the more general modeling capabilities of the language. All right, that was my 10-second introduction to Oslo and M. We're going to spend pretty much the rest of the time just in the text editor, so doing concrete examples. So what I brought up here, this is IntelliPad. So if you install there's an Oslo SDK that's available on the web right now. If you install it, one of the things that gets installed with it is IntelliPad. It's a lightweight text editor. Now, it's great for editing just text in general, but it also has a lot of built-in capabilities for working with M. So right now, actually, on this machine, this is all I have. I don't have Visual Studio installed or any other development environment. This is the only thing I've got is the Oslo SDK on this machine. For those of you familiar with Visual Studio, this actually does borrow from the Visual Studio editor, but that's about all. So what I'm going to do is I'm not just going to work with a plain text file. I'm actually going to begin by hitting Control-Shift-T to shift into DSL mode. And so to do that, I'm actually going to have to choose an MG file. So an MG stands for M grammar. Right now, we're in an interesting situation because although we have a single language M, it's currently built in two pieces. There's the language component of M, and then there's the schema and transform part of M. Over time, those will be unified. There will be one language, one set of tools. But for right now, if you work with the SDK, you're going to see this division in a number of places. So that's why I'm opening an MG file rather than just an M file. All right, so now what I have here is what's affectionately called three-pane mode. And the joke is, of course, it's called three-pane mode because there's four panes. It's also DSL mode. I'll also say that what you're going to see here, this was a build that I made about 48 hours ago. This will look and work slightly different than the code you can get online. I did that only because there were some problems I was running into with the publicly available bits, and so I had more control over this. So I'll try to point out where there are places where there are differences in what you would be doing if you were following along on your laptop.
Paul, are these bits at least checked into our debug?
Yes. Yes. Awesome. Yes. There are no custom changes I've made to these bits.
So it's not Paul's
edition. Yeah, this is not my personal edition. I just built it. And in fact, we should have an update soon. So you guys, yeah. So just to quickly walk through how the flow of this works. On the left here, I've got the actual DSL pane. So this is where the text of the DSL will appear. So I can actually type in here. So, you know, if I want to make this is a DSL. And here, let me increase the size here a little bit. Thank you, WPF. In the middle here is a pane that I will use to define the DSL. So this is where I type in M code. So I can type in a quick module here. DSL con with a language simple. Let's see. And I'm just going to have it recognize that just that statement. This is a DSL. Okay. All right. So in the middle is the DSL, is where I define the DSL. Oops. Oh, I'm not sure why I'm... Oh, yes, thank you. All right. Thank you very much. All right, and over here on the far pane, you see the results. So now, if we talk about sort of the flow of how M works, we're not actually, unlike a number of kind of DSL generators, we're not actually generating any code here. This is entirely in memory. So what's happening is we're compiling the middle, the language, that compiles into a binary image that contains the lexer and the parser tables necessary to, and the actions necessary to parse and build the language. And then we're running that in live on the actual DSL. And that what that produces then is an object model. So as I showed back on the slide about the concepts, the part M is a language, but it also has a standard data model called M graph. So what the output of a DSL parse is a graph, and that represents the data of the parse, and which you then can work with if you either either continue to process that in M. There's also a .NET object model for it. It's currently actually sort of in the process of being defined, but you can. So the output of the parser, which you can get in, you can new up a parser in C# or Visual Basic. You then parse, you get back an object representing the output graph, and you can then walk that graph and do any kind of processing you want. Okay, so that's kind of the general flow of how the language processing works in M. So now what we're going to do, mainly what I'm going to do in this talk, is we're just going to walk through all the capabilities of building a language in M. So the first thing I wanted to just kind of get some of the boilerplate out of the way, you see I started by defining a module. So all code in M is defined in modules. They just function as namespaces. And this is for the purpose of cross-module compilation. So for example, I can choose here to export the simple language out of my DSLCon module. Now, for IntelliPad, the DSL mode only handles one source file at a time. But you can actually have multiple, when you're doing batch compilation, when you're building an M project, you can have multiple modules, you can have languages, you can have schemas, you can have data. And so actually, I'm not going to show it much in this talk because we're going to walk through the capabilities of language. But so for example, there's a standard library of grammar productions that are included by default in every compilation. So they're automatically imported into the scope. And so we provide you like with a library of, say, common things like identifiers, white space, new lines, you know, all the kind of basic building blocks. Now I'm going to build them myself in this talk because it's going to help me walk through features of language. But we have a complete module system for export, import, cross-module references, that sort of thing. And the other sort of boilerplate aspect of the language I just wanted to touch on is, as you can kind of tell, because we have curly braces, you can guess this is really a C-style language. So a lot of the capabilities that you would expect and the syntax that you learned in C-sharp is available. So for example, you know, if I wanted to conditionally, you know, export, you know, I've got a preprocessor that's available here for me, and I can, you know, say define export. So, or for example, if I wanted to, you know, comment, I just use a standard, this is a simple language. Oops. This is a simple language. So if you're familiar with C-sharp or the C-style languages, this is going to be immediately familiar, and in fact, you'll be up and running pretty much in no time. Okay, so that's kind of all the boilerplate of kind of the sort of basic fundamental ideas of language. So let's start to, you know, dive into the actual capabilities of the language. So for the sort of theoretical, those who are well-versed in theory, what mGrammar generates is a GLR parser. So we take an LR strategy, generalized, so that we will allow certain ambiguities to occur in the grammar, and then we'll explore the multiple ambiguous pathways. And as long as it resolves itself, we will be able to produce a result. There is actually, I'm not going to show much today because I don't have time. There is the ability to also, from a programmatic standpoint, add your own language disambiguator. There is an API for that. That's pretty complicated, so I don't have time to show it today. But if you're building a language and you have some advanced ambiguity situations, you can actually do that by hand yourself. We'll give you access to the different parse states, so you can walk and decide which one is correct. In fact, we use that. I'd step back and say, you know, we use this capability. It's not just sort of a theoretical DSL building toolkit. We actually use it to build M itself. So we use all the same tools. In fact, I could bring up, you know, an MG file that describes the M language itself. So although it's designed to really build DSLs, it actually has an incredible amount of power in terms of the range of languages that it can express. All right, so let's actually dive into creating a language. So I'm going to start by redoing my language here. I'm just going to say that this is an empty language for the moment, because what I'm going to do by start with is I'm going to start by defining the lexical aspect of the language. So as I said, we do GLR parsing. So the parsing relies on a tokenizer. So you have to specify the lexical token level of your language first, and then we assemble that, you can assemble that into a language for the parser. So I've got right now an empty language that accepts nothing. And so I'm going to start by defining a couple of standard tokens for a language. So first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to create a token for an identifier. So it's in my language, an identifier is going to be the uppercase A through Z or lowercase A through Z, one or more of those. So you see the basic building blocks of the language are going to be characters. We support characters and character ranges. I also have the plus operator, which means one or more. We support the standard clean operators, the star, zero or more, plus, one or more, question mark, zero, one. So I'm going to also here, let's define a token for a number. And that's going to be 0 through 9 plus. And I'll also support floating points, so I'll have an optional numbers after the decimal point. Plus, question mark. So this is saying that a number is one or more 0 through 9, followed by an optional period with more numbers after it. So what I can do here now is I can go ahead and just say, well, my language is just a single identifier at this point, and I'll see I get automatic result. Or I could say it's a number, and here we can try out, you know, 10.23 or just 10. So this is great. In addition to the plus, star plus, and question mark, we also support count operators. So, for example, if I wanted to have numbers be even thousands, I could specify this instead as that a number is 0 through 9, and there's three of them followed by a comma, and then I could have zero more of those, and then I would have three of these. So now if I specify just 10, I'm going to get an error because I don't have three digits here. If I put in a zero, it'll fill in, and then I can do, you know, so I can. So basically, we're pretty flexible in terms of the counting and repetition operators. So actually, I'm going to just go back though on this, go back to just a regular number here. All right. So we've got identifiers, we've got numbers. I also want to add I'm going to go ahead and add strings to this language, string constants. So let's do a string literals. So a string is a double quote character followed by one or more characters that is not a double quote character and an end double quote. So here shows a couple more capabilities. In addition to regular characters, there's a standard any, there's a predefined any character which will match anything, and it's mostly useful in the case of like here where I can also do subtraction. So I can say any character but quote, or I could say, you know, A to Z minus Q if I wanted to accept any character but Q, that sort of thing. I'm also going to define a comment so that I can have comments in my language, and I'm just going to do a C style comment. And what I'm going to want here is I'm going to want a slash star to open it. Now, and then I'm going to want to accept either any character that's not a star or a star that is not followed by a slash. So this will allow me to put stars, you know, stars and comments. So if I put, let me save. Comment here, and a star slash star, and it'll correctly balance it. So I can use the inversion operator to say anything but a particular character, and then I can use that to build up basically patterns to match anything but sort of the end sequence of a particular comment. Okay, so now we've got the basic building blocks of a language. We've got all the tokens. Now, before I move on to actually starting to assemble them into a language, there is one thing I'm going to do. Now, if you notice, you know, I've already, what's happening here is as I type in things, I'm automatically getting things in the right pane. So what we do in M is when you define a token or a syntax, we'll define a default action that we assign to that rule. And usually that is just to produce whatever text for a token. It'll be produce whatever text this token matched. Now, in some cases, like say for a string, if I have a string here, and I change this, what I'm going to see is you'll see that the default action gives me the entire text that was matched. So it gives me the double quotes as well. Now, probably for my when I'm processing my language, I really don't want to have to strip out those double quotes. So what I'd like to do, what I'm going to do, is I'm going to create a specific action for when that token matches, and I'm going to use it to just match the text of the string. So here I'm going to go down to the string, and I'm going to say there's a variable s that just binds to the text that occurs between the double quotes. And actually here I'm going to give myself a little more space, so we can hopefully all see this. And then I'm going to put the action operator and say the action will be, I'm just going to give it string S. Okay, so now you'll see that I now produce, the double quotes are just the default sort of, that's saying that's what the text is. It's not actually part of the value. I also gave it a label. So I'm just going to touch very briefly. This is where we get into the M data model. The M graph model is just a very simple model of labels that can have value, a list of values after them. So what I did here is I creating a very simple graph that has the label string and then has one element contained within it, and that's the string test. And I can build these graphs up to be quite big. And so these graphs can actually function as a kind of as a representation of the output of the parse, as a parse tree, or depending on how much processing you do, you know, however, if you want to go beyond that, you can maybe get closer to semantic trees. Sure.
Representing that piece, not the token type string.
Right, yeah, I could put anything here. I could say, you know, anything. And it's just going to, it's just a label. So, right, I typically will use the name of the token or the syntax as the label just because it's a nice it's a nice concordance, but yes, you can do anything. And I could, you know, I could have arbitrary. You know, actually, I'll show this in just a second, actually. We'll get a little more into some of the more advanced things you can do with graphs. So I'm going to quickly just add actions here for my other tokens. So for an identifier, I'll just produce an identifier graph. And for the number, I will produce a number graph. Here we go. All right. And I'm not actually going to produce a graph for comments because they're just going to be white space. I'm going to filter them out in a minute. All right, great. So now I have the sort of basic building blocks. I have the basic lexical building blocks of the language.
And this grammar, how easy or difficult is it to deal with recursive definitions? Let's say like an escaped double quote within the string or something like that in your token definition?
It can be challenging. We should. We can talk about it. And maybe at the end if there's time. Okay, so, all right. Okay, wow, okay, time goes quickly. Well, we'll try to speed it up here, so since we got kind of the basics here. All right, so now let's build this into more of a language. So I'm going to now say, instead of just this language being a string, I'm going to accept the empty string, and that's just going to produce a graph, which is just an empty program. And then I'm also going to support statements. I'm just going to have a program that can be a single statement. Okay. So now we're going to build. Now we need to build the syntax for a statement. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to build a very simple statement that only supports an assignment statement. So I'm going to say it's a let statement, and it's going to take an identifier and an equals and something that I'm going to define in a moment, an expression, and then I'm going to produce a tree, a graph that is name. I and value E. So here we see another graph capability, which is that inside of a list, inside of a graph list, I can assign values names. I can choose either to just do them positionally, which is what I was doing for tokens, or I can also name them so that I can have name value pairs. So, yeah?
Could you change that semicolon to a bar so I can pay attention again? All I can do is see that semicolon.
Which semicolon?
Higher, warmer.
Oh, thank you. It's not going to get rid of all the. It's not going to get rid of all the errors because I still haven't identified. Whoa. I still have not. Oops. All right. Here we go. All right. Now we're just down to the point where I haven't defined expression. All right. So let's just create a very simple set of expressions, which will just be an Actually, we'll just identifier or a number. Okay, so now I have a very simple language, and I'm going to type a little statement here, let x equals 10. All right, so now the first thing I'm going to notice is I get errors. I'm getting errors because the one thing I haven't dealt with here is white space. And I don't really, now what I could do is I could go through and either in lexical level or the syntactic level, I could go through and specify white space everywhere I wanted it to be ignored. But I can actually do that much more simply. We have a special token rule, interleave, which will just allow me to ignore things like spaces. So what interleave is basically, it's a token that anytime we encounter that token, we'll scan it and then we'll throw it away. It's ignored for the purposes of parsing.
It's still actually parsed out mgraph for you, Yes. Even though there was an error coming out?
Yeah, and I will do my best to get to error recovery. That's you know, at the end. So I want to actually talk for a moment about an interesting parsing aspect really quickly here. Now you notice that I actually, here I say let equals 10. Now, when I said let in the syntax statement, this is essentially an inline token. It was as if, and it's a completely equivalent down here to saying, let me give it a little space, token let equals let. It's a nice way so that you don't actually have to, you know, define all of these rules and give them names. Yeah?
Could you discuss the differences between this and
antlers? Why don't we get to that in questions? It's a long talk, a long discussion. So the interesting thing is here that you'll notice is that we actually have an overlap. I've got this keyword, let, identified here, which actually overlaps with the token identifier. So normally what would happen is you'd get an ambiguity here. We don't know whether you have an identifier. Or did you mean the identifier let, or did you mean the keyword let? And what happens today, this is one of the differences between what you have, what you could put on your machines, and what we've got, what I have on my machine, is that today you would actually have to mark the identifier with a special modifier, identifier. Which if you did, then that says, okay, this is an identifier token, so allow keywords, allow text literals to match this, but give the text literals higher priority. So don't think of them as ambiguous. If you encounter a keyword, then think of it as a keyword. If it's otherwise, just think of it as an identifier. We've actually now built this in automatically, so we'll automatically detect this situation, so that's why I didn't have to specify identifier. Now, if I wanted to reserve let, if I didn't want it to be used as an identifier, I could go down and I could specify final on the token, let. And then what final means then is don't let any, this is it. This is the only token that can match this string. Do not allow anything else to match to it. And now you see that we'll get an error saying that where we thought we were getting an identifier before, now we're getting a keyword. So this is how you do reserved keywords in DSLs and M. Okay, so.
You have ambiguous tokenization. So you have letter, yes, equals 10.
Right. If you have multiple tokens that are not literals and they overlap, then you'll just get an ambiguity error. There's very little we can do about that. You're going to have to resolve that on your own. We do as much as we can automatically, but when we can't, we...
You're going to go and say you have the identifier, L-E-T-T-E-R, and the...
Right, we only...
Followed by the identifier, T-E-R.
We will detect if you have overlapping final tokens. If you said this is the only interpretation for this, and you do have two if you have two final tokens that are the same, we will warn you that you have an overlap. But in other situations, because the GLR algorithm may resolve the ambiguity through the syntax, we allow them to overlap and we won't warn you. That is a possibility we could do. So,
yeah. Will this bubble up into the syntax level to help with things like the dangling else problem?
Let me get to that. We're actually almost there. I just wanted to take a quick moment, though, and say, so now the nice thing on the middle part is you notice I get all this nice colorization. You know, keywords are bolded and comments are italicized. So I'd really actually like that in my grammar on the left pane. And I actually can do that if I add a little bit of metadata here. I can say that the classification for comment is comment, which is something that IntelliPad understands. And then I've forgotten to actually put a comment up here. But if I have one, all right, I'm not sure, I have to interleave a couple of more things. I have to interleave new lines. I left them out in the interest of time. All right. Okay, so now I'm getting automatic colorization, and if I want the keywords to be colorized, I can also do that. I can say that the classification for the let token is a keyword. And then it, once it catches up, it automatically bolds it. So now this is the beginning of what we're planning on building. Right now, we only have colorization based on attributes in the grammar. Our goal is longer term to have a richer set of language services automatically built off the grammar so that you could get things like automatic keyword completion and syntax completion, syntax tips, anything that can be done off the grammar, obviously anything that relates to semantics or binding we couldn't actually do automatically. But for IntelliPad at least, we want to provide as many services built automatically off your grammar as humanly possible. Okay, so now that I've got it all pretty, let's actually talk a little bit about precedences, because that was the question, and that's usually a pretty big topic. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add, let me go up here, I'm going to add an expression, and I'm going to add an addition to my language here. So I'm going to say an expression plus another expression, and I'm going to produce plus left op L, right op R. So I'm going to create a little graph for that. And I've got to put this bar here. Okay. So now I can say 10 plus 10, and I get a nice graph over on the other side. But of course, if I add another one in here, I'm going to get a result, but I'm actually going to get a warning here. And the problem is, of course, that I've said 10 plus 10 plus 10, and it doesn't automatically know what the associativity of this is. So it could go either way. Is it 10 plus 10 plus 10, or is it 10 plus 10 plus 10? So I need to specify the associativity of this. Yeah, bad example, I know. So I can add, with the left operator here, I can specify the associativity of that particular operator. I could also said that it has right associativity if I wanted, and that will, you'll notice that as I change it, the right-hand side, the graph shifts in response to the changes I have. But I want to leave it left associative. So now if I also want to have multiplication in this language, I'm going to make it left associative as well. Left op, right op. So now I have addition and multiplication, and I put that in. And for some reason, I'm not getting an ambiguity here. Maybe I'm. Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, for some reason, I'm actually not getting an ambiguity here, but I guess maybe it's not ambiguous, maybe I'm just a prioritization. Actually, yes, that's what's going on. I apologize. So what's happening here is right now they're of equal priority, so it's just whatever is left to right. It's left to right. So if I have plus and times, if I look over here, we do the plus, and then we do, you know, the plus occurs first because it's the first one we get to, and it's the times is done second. Now, if I wanted to raise the priority, if I wanted to have times be a higher precedence, I can just raise its precedence in the associativity operator here, and now I'm getting the multiplication done first and then the addition done second. So I still haven't gotten to your question, but we did the expression precedences. So now let's talk about the case of if. Let me flip over here. So that's at the expression level. So let's take a look now at the statement level. So let's say I did create an if statement that had two forms. So it was, you know, if expression, then some statement, or if. And for right now, I'm just going to let it, in the interest of time, because time is going quickly, I'm just going to let it do the default rules here, default actions. Or if I had s expression, then some statement, I guess I'm still doing variables, else some other statement. Okay, so now I can have the statement, which is, you know, if X, then, you know, if Y, then 10, else 20. Statement. Oh, I actually need to have here, let me just have a, then let X equals 10. Apologize for the, it's hard to fit all this stuff on here. Yeah, let's, we'll just do it quickly here. Well, I'm just going to say, so what we have here is if, oops, an if, and a then, and an else. So the question, of course, is we're getting a green here warning because we can go, it could go either way. Which if is the else is supposed to be associated with? Yeah?
Why it gives you the warning when you actually type the statement?
Excuse me?
Why it gives you the warning when you actually type the sample statement, not immediately as you type the grammar?
It's the analysis is done, the ambiguity is realized at the point at which you're actually parsing.
Sorry.
You do an ambiguity check on the grammar, you parse and say, hey, I had two ways to parse this.
Yeah, yeah, well, there, that's true. And we should talk more about the exact, I mean, there's a certain level of ambiguity checking that can be easily done when we're processing the grammar. There's some that's left open, especially since ambiguities might be resolved at the point of parsing. So anyway, we can talk more about it after the running quickly short of time. So. So what we have here is an ambiguity that we're determining because we don't know whether the dangling else, which of the if statements is associated with. And so what I can have is then I can explicitly set for production in a syntax the priority of that production. So I can say that the precedence of this one is 1 and then the precedence of the else is higher, if I can spell. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I'm not gonna. I never win points for spelling. Sorry about that. So I've resolved the ambiguity in this case by adding explicit precedences to the productions. Okay, so let me sync up here where I am. Okay, so for one of the last two tricks, hopefully I've got two tricks up my sleeve. So now what I've got right now is I've got a language that can take a single statement. What I'd like to do is have a language that can take a series of statements separated by semicolons. Now, there's a naive way. I could just do it naively. I can create a syntax statement that has basically parses a list. But, of course, I know that in a language, lists occur lots of times. It's a very common idiom to have a list of something separated by something. And so what I'd like to do is create a general rule that I can use in all of those situations. So rather than creating some specific rule, I'm going to create a parameterized rule that allows me to reuse it in lots of places. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to create a list that's going to take two parameters, an element type and a separator type. Actually, not a type, it's a rule. An element rule that applies for the elements of the list and a rule that applies for the separator. And basically what this what this is going to produce is it's going to say, well, either it's going to take an element, and we'll just produce, let's see, a list with that element, or it's going to take a list of that element and separator, followed by the separator, followed by an element, and that's going to produce a list the values of L concatenated with E. So now what values of will do is the list is going to return me a list of elements, and I'm going to unwrap that list and inject those elements directly into the new list. Essentially, I'm concat. It's concat. I'm concatenating the element onto the end of this list. And so now what I can do up here is I can say instead of a statement, I can say a program is actually a list of statement separated by semicolon. Okay. And I'll now be able to say, you know, let x equals 10, let y equals 20, let z equals 30. So it's and the nice thing about this is I can take this rule and I can reuse it. So if I want to have a list of expressions or if I want to have a list of other declarations, I can just reuse the rule and just pass in different parameters. I can pass in different element rules, different separator rules. And of course, I can chain these together and actually, it's a great way to very succinctly build up a pretty sophisticated grammar, because what we find is that in a lot of cases, grammars have lots of repetitions. They have lots of structures that you use over and over and over again. So this is a great way of simplifying that. It won't be accepted with this simple grammar. It'd have to do a little more complex. I'm just, for the purposes of demo, I'm just sort of...
Not a terminator.
So, yes, question.
And tell me if this is going to take us on a tangent.
Sure.
If I wanted to do carriage return line termination, what would the syntax look like? Can I, because carriage return is frequently considered a white space.
Right. So in this grammar right now, because down in, if you look down in the, if we go down to the interleave, it's currently ignored. It is possible right now, actually, either a token shows up in interleave or it shows up in the grammar. So you can't say ignore all white space except in this place. That is a pretty common request we've been getting, and so I think it's something we're going to add pretty quickly, because, you know, as I look at like. Yeah, a number of languages. You know, it's white space is not significant except in this one situation right here where I need it. So, yeah, exactly. Let's see. All right, we got 5 minutes left. Let's see. Choose either nest or error recovery. Why don't we talk about error recovery? And if we have time to talk about nest, we'll talk about it. Okay. So of course, one situation that I might run into is if users typed in correct code all the time, that would be wonderful. But of course, that never happens. You know, so if I type in here some garbage, I pretty much lose everything. I don't get any output. I do get some colorization, which is great because that's working at the lexical level. But I'm not getting anything. And so of course, if all I care about is batch compilation, maybe that's not too bad. But in situations like where I'm trying to build editing services, or I'm trying to work with malformed grammars, I need a more advanced way of doing error recovery. And so what we do support in mgrammar is we support specifying an error token that allows you to say, well, if you hit an error, you know, just keep going until you can recover at the end of this production. So for example, I can say here, I can say, well, here, I'm going to take a list of element and separator and a separator and an error. And I'm just going to produce a list of the values of L. All right. And hopefully and so now, magically, I get I now actually skip over the error. So what this error token is basically saying is just that when we hit, we parse the first statement, then we hit the junk, and we say, well, okay, just keep lexing, looking for the next token that will allow you to recover at the end of a list of statements. We're also looking at some of the more advanced error recovery techniques. This is a very manual method. You have to put in errors everywhere. Excuse me?
Your syntax highlighting didn't recover.
Yes, unfortunately. That actually, yeah, that's based off the token level, not the syntax level for the moment. Although as we get to more complex,
the syntax level, it got the tokens needed, though.
Well, hang on just a second, actually. We've got a minute or two. I have a few more minutes? Okay, all right. I got a couple more minutes. Well, then I'll show very quickly one of the interesting things is leading us towards actually not just relying on tokens, but relying more on syntax. And that is, like, if I wanted to imagine that I wanted to create something like, say I wanted to allow an expression that was something a little like XML. So I have this expression, and I'm going to say it's going to have a start tag, which I'm going to save, and it's going to have some content, and then it's going to have an end tag, and that's going to produce a element, which is going to be the tag name, and it's going to be the content. All right, so I need to define those. So we're going to define a couple of tokens. So start tag is open brace, an identifier, and a close. Produces an identifier here. Let's create some space. Now, an in tag is just going to be the thing you would expect. I'm going to make it unnamed here for the moment. And content. Whoops, thank you. All right. So now, this is basically, I just want to create the ability to have a tag that has anything in it and an in tag. Now, I created this, and my grammar goes wild. And that's because what happens now is it goes back to the idea, these are tokens. So this token here, content, this will match anything. This will consume everything. So what's happening is I have one token in my one token that I parse here called content, because it will eat absolutely everything. And so what I really want to do is I want to say, no. Actually, this content only happens in an isolated context. Content should only be parsed if it occurs between a start tag and an end tag. And so what we have is the capability right now to do that. So we say, here, I'm going to have to split it out into a separate syntax. But I say syntax nest element, nest syntax. So what nest says is, between this token and this token, only look for these kinds of tokens. And don't look for these kind of tokens outside of this context. It creates a separate protected sort of lexical context that allows you to have these kind of overlapping tokens. Now, there's still a lot of limitations to what this can do, and in fact, one of the things we're going to be working on in the near future is ways in which you can actually do this without having to specify nest, where we can automatically detect the situation for you and say, oh, well, you know, of course, content only occurs here, so, you know, if I see it in some other context, I'm not going to notice it. I'm not going to pay any attention to it. But this is what you're going to get for right now. And
Paul, on that note.
Yes.
These bits, are they available for people to use right now?
Yes, they are. The one major change, I noticed the identifier before, this equals arrow in the bits that you have now is just equals. That's one minor syntax change that will be coming down later. But otherwise, you should be able to do everything I just demoed today.
And where can they get more information about this fabulous technology?
Well, I'm glad you asked. I'm glad to see that Chris actually read my slides. So we have a dev center, which the illustrious Mr. Sells, I believe, is responsible for, where you can get the SDK, you can play with it. I've got a blog if you want to know more about the gruesome details of grammar. There's a team blog if you want to know about M in general. And the last thing I'd emphasize is we are at an incredibly early stage with this stuff. I mean, we've come a long way. There's a long way to go. And so your feedback is vitally important to us. If there are things you hate, things you'd like to see, let us know, because you can still influence it. It's the right time for that. So I'll take as many questions as I can take before I get cut off.
Thank you very much, Paul Vick.
All right, no questions. I'll be right here. Thank you.